So today we start entirely new. So linear logic is our linear logic is our new batch of is the new formality that we want to attack. And actually both linear logic and the logic of bunch implications that we want to attack next can be seen as falling into broader umbrella of substructural logic. So maybe before I tell you more about specifically linear logic itself, especially that it involves lots of connectives, and it would be rather strange to throw all of this together. Maybe let's go slowly and see where the idea could possibly come from and why linear logic is such a crazy interesting and actually much easier to understand than it may seem at the beginning beast. So maybe let's state a few things at the very beginning. So the Gensel calculi that we were using so far for both intuitionistic logic and classical logic, they were carefully designed to fulfill several purposes, and also in the modal case. For example, we wanted to be able to, as I already told you, one of the goals was that by feigning proof self, we wanted to be able to immediately extract contour models. And they were built in such a way that structural rules, such as weakening and contraction, they were derived rather than assumed. And this is fine, but this is not the only way in which one could possibly do Gensel calculi for intuitionistic or for classical logic or another system. And we may wonder then what would happen if we don't assume that we have such structural rules, when those rules are added on top rather than to a Gensel system which allows us a little bit more freedom to design. So first of all, we have several ways in which we could approach connectives like conjunction and disjunction even, and basic ways how you combine information on the left and on the right hand side of the sequence. So, should I write anything for what I said? Probably not. Okay, so let's just state that in absence of structural rules, especially weakening and contraction, I mean, traditionally, one also includes exchange among structural rules. Exchange is simply the idea that you can write premises in any order, on the left-hand side of the tensile or tensile sequent arrow, or also whatever you write on the right-hand side of the sequent arrow. But here it is kind of built in because we assume that we're dealing with multisets all the time. If we wanted to be even more careful, then we would start with lists, right? And then we would have explicitly to say if we allow a rule which allows us to permute members of lists. But here we're going to stick to a setup with multisets. I mean, there are many structural logics which don't even take this step of allowing exchange. But linear logic is cool with this. And another rule which is often called a structural rule is cut itself. But the status of cut is rather different than the status of weakening, contraction, or exchange. So in absence of structural rules, several possible ways to introduce conjunction disjunction and to combine information on both sides of the sequent arrow. Let us have a more careful look, because we didn't, I think, did any exercise so far which would clarify the meaning of the sentence that I just wrote on the blackboard. So let's stick with conjunction, because this is probably the most important thing. So on the one hand, we know that so far we were looking at the conjunction as simply combining two formulas on the left-hand side into one, right? So but let's say that we want to capture the idea that conjunctions should behave like greatest lower bound. Those of you who know lattice theory, that we know the lattice meet, or set intersection, that it is the greatest of formulas that that is providing you all the information that alpha does, but also all the information that beta does. This rule doesn't look particularly meaningful. If you think of this sequent arrow simply as inequality sign in mathematics, what would you rather say is, well, first of all, it has to be like a lower bound. So if you could deduce something from alpha, then you can deduce it even more from alpha, beta, and let's call it lattice-like, but this is not a very good term. We will see better names afterwards. Conjunction combines two formulas on the left. And then there is the issue of the right rule for conjunction that in this setting should complete our definition, simply that which for the time being, if you look on the left rules, is only saying that this is lower bound but not necessarily greatest lower bound. And actually, what is happening on the right with conjunction is even more interesting, because here we are getting even closer to the issue of how to combine information. In what way information is being combined. So if we stick to this idea that conjunctions should simply tell you, should be the greatest lower bound, well, actually depends whether you talk about logic order, information order, those things are upside down. The stronger you are logically, the less information you carry from information point of view. So here you just want to say that if you are below alpha and if you are below beta, then you are below alpha and beta. Nothing funny is happening on the left-hand side. But then what if you want to combine two different pieces of information on the left-hand side of the third style? You could also say that if you have this, and if you have this, sorry, I forgot about delta q. Then, if you provide me both gamma alpha and gamma 2, you provide alpha 1 and alpha 2. So here you are putting two different contexts together. I didn't make any mistake with copying deltas and so on. I guess not. Okay. So, does it really matter? Well, not if we have weakening and contraction. Let's see how it works. So, let's try to derive, I don't want to say left and right rules because this means something else, but rules on the side of the window, from the side, those on the side of the sink, and the side of the, those on the side of the sink from those on the side of the window. So this is like more information theoretic. I mean, we'll maybe carefully start using the word multiplicative, although I will justify it later, and this is more like additive treatment of information. So, well, maybe let's use this blackboard first. So let's assume that I will not justify this phrase for having multiplicative. Let's assume that we have this, and let's call this additive. And now let's see how we go from one direction to the other. So, let's assume that these are the primitive rules for conjunction. And now assume that you gave me this piece of information. I want to derive that I can also obtain delta from alpha and beta. Well, if I have in presence, I should write clearly, in presence of structural rules, so I can also throw any junk that I want on the left-hand side if I have weakening as explicit rule on the left. And now, voila, here we are, right? That's all that our rule, multiplicative left conjunction. So that's easy piece. And now for in the right rule for conjunction. So assume that I have this rule as a primitive. And somebody gave me this piece of information and this piece of information, and then I want to be here. So, well, all I can use is this. So I'm saying gamma, gamma, alpha, beta, delta, delta. It looks as if I am stuttering. But now, this is precisely what is taken care of by the contraction stuff, actually on the left and on the right. And here we need contraction on both sides, actually. Unless we formulate a rule for a sequence system which does not allow multiple conclusions on right-hand side, but we will discuss it in a minute. Sorry. This should be conjunction, of course. So I killed those redundancies. So that's how it goes here, but maybe we are equally lucky in the other direction. So assume now that somebody, I have those rules as primitives, and somebody gave me this. So now I want to arrive at this thing. What I can do? Well, first of all, exchange. We can reorder things, or if you prefer, we can start from this one. And then apply this rule. So beta is part of extended gamma, like gamma prime, right? So additive. And then, but with beta, now, so now this is another extended gamma, and this is the formula in focus, or the principal formula, as the theorists say. Again. So that's good. And same game, maybe I could actually do this exercise, but for speed, let's do it myself. So same situation now on the right-hand side. So this is now my primitive rule for conjunction. And somebody is giving me this. Well, now I apply structural rules as many times as possible, right? Multiple application of weakening. On the left and on the right. Sorry, maybe I should write it separately for timing. So I apply it here. As many times, sorry, this is delta 1, this is delta 2. This is, here I apply it as many times on the left as the, we have elements of gamma 1, and as many times on the right as we have element of delta 1, and here as many times on the left as we have element of gamma 2, and as many times on the right as we have element of delta 2, sorry, the umgekehrt. So here I apply it as many times as we have elements of gamma 2, and on the right as we have elements of delta 2, and here I apply it as many times as we have element of gamma 1, and here on the right as many times as we have element of delta 1, in order to arrive, as you may guess, at this. Not? I copied and copied and copied until chaos came home. So now I have the same context on the left, and well, how to call it, co-context on the right-hand side. And by additive rules or conjunction, I'm getting so all is well. But if we attach some price tag, let's say, to use of premises, if our premises are not infinitely replicable, but they are more like coins in your pocket, then these two ways of thinking about connectives, and of course similar story will happen now on the right and conjunction, right? These two ways of treating them will become very, very different. And in fact, we are talking probably here about two different connectives. As soon as we drop structural rules. Well, I'm already guiding you towards the idea that some people wanted to drop them, and I will quickly go through land release of various formalisms and logics where it happened for different reasons. But before we look at examples of such sub-structural logics, now we can understand probably that this sub comes from the idea that some of the structural rules are dropped. Let's think what would be other consequences of dropping them. So even truth constant may behave in two different ways. On the one hand, you may think of truth constant as the strongest logical formula, which is strongest logically or most useless from information point of view. So something which, if you think of this in terms of lattice order, is above everything else. So one way of looking at truth constants is that you have this, right? Every possible context, in particular, every formula is below top. But there is also a different way of looking at truth context. Remember that we already had this idea, this discussion, at truth constant. We already had this idea, what is possibly the product or multiplication or conjunction of empty set. And in our setup, one way when we can obviously encounter empty sets is empty context on the left-hand side of the tensor. So another way of looking at the truth constant is to look at it as the monoid or the unit element for comma, so to say. So something which is obtained as a product of empty set of premises. What would that be? Well, first, it means that if this is like monoid unit for comma, adding it to any context does not change the game. And also it is implied by, let me write this differently. This is not very consistent because then I should already start writing two different connectives here, but for the time being I wanted to be a bit schizophrenic with what connectives we have in mind. So, again, an exercise for us now is to make sure that in presence of structural rules, we have both this and this. So these two connectives are equivalent. This is actually coming for free, because this is true for any context, in particular the one which is consisting just of single formula with this monoidal. So here, truth as the greatest element in the lattice order or perhaps logically strongest or informationally useless. it's so useless that for this thing it doesn't even make sense to introduce introduction rule on the left. Here we have truth as neutral monoid neutral element or monoid unit of comma. Well, actually, as you can probably guess, it won't be just comma, because comma is not a connective in our logic. It would be the connective which is now, which will now legally be encoding the behavior on the comma on the left-hand side, the multiplicative conjunction. So this would be like additive truth, and this would be like multiplicative truth. So always, because everything is below top. But for this, we may need some work. Anybody see how to get here? Well, this is just weakening, right? So if I have weakening on the left, then from such a sequence, I can obtain this. But actually, it works both ways. So if you assume that you have such neutral element for comma, which at the same time is really the greatest element in this logical order, you would be able to obtain at least one important contraction rule. If the neutral multiplicative truth coincides with additive you can derive weakening using cup. How does it work? So let us summarize that we have this as the left rule and this as the right rule. Pervert, right, one. We want to be able to replace this guy, but by any phi. But we can, in particular, consider this phi to be this gamma here. So, pervert one axiom the left axiom for a monoidal unit, and now using cup we're getting that gamma phi is producing delta. So we obtain income on the left. So even this kind of things are not necessarily innocent, and this is one of many reasons why we stress all the time that we cannot just take one rule from another calculus and, you know, replace it by seemingly innocent-looking variant from another calculus, because, like in this case, well, here you need to have a cut as explicit rule rather than admissible one. You can suddenly obtain surprising consequences, like the fact that you have structural rules where you don't necessarily want to have it. What else? So it might also be the case that having several possible ways of defining the one and the same connective and unrestricted access to structural rules produces some additional laws that we didn't even think are valid, but yet they are. Let us think in particular about the law of distributivity. Another consequence of presence of structural rules, additional laws are derivable. For example, distributivity. Actually, some of those things will come back to us on more sophisticated level, where we're going to separate carefully different possible this additive and the multiplicative approach to connectives, and have separate connectives for both. So it might be that we will still have some form of distributivity, but it won't be necessarily lattice distributivity, the distributivity of the lattice connectives between each other. Let's see. So what we want to derive is that phi psi or chi is this. Let's do a simple search. This, of course, is encoding disjunction on the right-hand side, assuming we have the structural rules. And the converse direction is rather obvious because of monotonicity of those connectives. So this is the interesting bit. So how do we go about it? Shall we use freely both treatments of the connectives, or shall we rather stick to one of those pairs of rules as primitive? So if you go for a multiplicative reading of conjunction, and now, by the left disjunction rule, you need to show that phi psi produces phi and psi, and phi and chi, or phi and chi. This command on the right should be read rather as or than and. phi and I lost something here. Phi and psi. Nobody's protesting. Phi and chi. And well, if I have now weakening on the left, on the right, sorry. Well, you can guess that this is the one I want to keep and this is the one I want to throw away. Whereas here, I do analogous things, but keeping phi and chi. And from this, it's plain sailing. So there were many additional interactions between connectives, which are hidden in the setup where one can use structural rules freely. Actually, what we have not done is to give you some natural variant of a sequence system for either intuitionistic or classical logic where those rules are not derivable, they are not built in, but they are explicitly postulated as axioms. Would it be useful before we proceed further to have a quick look at like how such a system for classical logic should look like? Well, as I said, it will have structural rules explicitly as the rules, weakening and contraction on the left and on the right. It will have those rules rather than those rules, as rules for conjunction, and dual situation will happen with disjunction. Will there be some reformulation in the left implication rule? Compared to what we used to have. So this will be a perfectly valid alternative system, Gensen system for classical logic, which in Trost and Fischlichtenberg's book is called G1. And it will be much easier to turn such a system to a system for intuitionistic logic. Namely, there will be very easy restriction, and actually here is where one needs to be a bit careful with left implication rule, but otherwise everything goes through very smoothly. You say simply that in all the sequence and in all the rules, on the right-hand side of the sequence arrow, you are not allowed to use more than one formula. Maybe let me write some of those things. Takes additive rules for conjunction and disjunction. And its modification for intuitionistic logic is obtained by restricting all multisets on the right-hand side of the arrow. To a single formula, to at most a single formula, so they can be empty. Plus a slight tweak in the left implication rule. So you could argue, and actually this is what the inventor of linear logic, Jean-Yves Girard, does in his paper, is that this idea of restricting structural rules is already present in a sense when you move from classical to intuitionistic logic. You simply make very crude or higher level restriction on structural rules on the right, because there is not much structural stuff that can happen on the right if you have at most one formula. But it is possible to go much further, and as I said, this is an idea common to many more formalisms than just linear logic that I want to tell you about now. So maybe let's first overview at least most important formalisms where structural rules were killed, and most of the time we had at least different types of conjunction and possibly some other connectives as well. Maybe let us keep that side of the blackboard for a while. And maybe let me add that if you want to read up anything for yourself or look for additional information, Trost and Schickenberg book, this is actually what they would call G1 style approach, the one with explicit structural rules. And in their book, it comes in chapter 3, before they start to discuss systems, Gensen systems in the way we introduced them originally for intuitionistic and classical logic. So the idea of removing some of structural rules reappeared many times in history. The first occurrence actually happened well before Gensen paper, so it is a logic which only from contemporary point of view we can describe as substructural, because it couldn't have been presented as such. And this is the first, or one, two first logical formalisms, formal systems, which explicitly throw away the idea that you have only two logical values, truth and false. Even before Gensen. So substructural only from contemporary perspective. one of two earliest formalisms rejecting two valued semantics. Łukasiewicz three valued logic. Later generalized to MVN and MV infinity for however many values you want to have. At the same year, it was almost exactly in parallel, American logician Emil Post even involved another free-valued formalism, but its relationship to even minimal substructural logic, as we would like to discuss here, would be slightly more complicated. And then this is already a starting point for a huge enterprise in its own right. And if we had more time in our course, then this would be perhaps the first piece of material together with propositional dynamic logic that we would add, namely the whole idea of fuzzy logics. So later fuzzy logics, which are properly substructural, the product logic, pi. And this is particularly interesting logic from the point of view of this multiplicative terminology, because there are the truth values, the formulas are interpreted in 0-1 interval, And the multiplicative conjunction is interpreted, well, as multiplication, which is not exactly the case in Łukasiewicz setup. This is different connectives. Hayek's basic fuzzy logic, of course, and further generalization. Typically, they include the axiom of linearity or prior linearity that you spend now so much time playing around with in exercise 5. One more important thing, which is, well, I could say it also later, but it's worth stating as soon as possible. Already on this example, you would be able to see, if we had time to go into details of fuzzy logic, which alas we don't, you would see that it is not necessarily the case that logics obtained by I mean, I was describing them as if they were obtained simply by dropping structural rules. Many other things may be happening as well. So it is not necessarily the case that, for example, those fuzzy logics, like Lukasiewicz logic, would be sublogics of intuitionism. Actually, they are not. They have some additional interactions, like negation behaving a bit classically. So you have again this double negation law that was banned from intuitionism, and you can even define away connectives like implication, which again was not possible in intuitionism. So it is not that you have intuitionism and classical logic somewhere on the top, and then you may add some other connectives to obtain stuff like monad logic. Here we are still, because those logic tend to have weakening but don't have contraction, this type of logics, they are still at least containing classical logics. But some of the examples I will tell you further, they won't even have to be as good. They will have, they can be themselves comparable with classical logic, but they will have extensions which are not even comparable with classical logic. So maximal consistent logics which are unlike classical one. They are not the next time I'm trying to go more or less chronologically, if it is possible at all, and if I wanted to be super accurate or super pedantic, I will have to mention that you could trace even this idea of having more than two logical values much earlier. So many people attribute first multivalued logic to American logician and the author of even the word semantics, philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, from the guy who is behind the name Peirce syllogism, but this is not the author of Benjamin Peirce Types in Programming Languages book in the late 19th century. But probably the formalisms of Lukasiewicz and Post were the first to develop calculi with semantics. So the next thing that happened in 1940 or already in 1950s was when people were starting to look at logical structure of natural language and sentences. And this is the idea of first categorical grammars of Aidukiewicz in 1940s and then categorical logic of Lambeck in 1950s. This has nothing to do with category theory, by the way. Logical analysis of grammar. This is too general because many things can be described as logical analysis of grammar. I can tell you very, very briefly what it is. Crucial for us at this moment. The idea was that if you think, for example, about, let's say, proper names like Tadeusz, Sergei, Luz, or whatever, then these are entities. And then the other important kind of things are sentences. And then you have things which are used to turn entities or nouns into sentences. So, for example, Tadeusz talks would be some, if Tadeusz is like entity, and talks is like on the left and on the right. Is something you can use to turn entity into a sentence. So now if you combine these two things, this is like this modificative conjunction, and then, you know, The reason why I'm writing this rather than implication is because one really wants to be careful in natural language whether you write things on the left and on the right-hand side. So you don't necessarily want to have the exchange rule. Tadeusz talks and talks Tadeusz is not necessarily the same thing linguistically. So then if you multiply these two things, this thing will cancel out with this one and you will obtain a sentence. Or a special case of a sentence, something which implies a sentence, or tensile arrow a sentence. And then there are many other syntactic categories, like when you have not a proper noun, like but the bird, or the room, or the sink, then this is something which, given a verb, like the sink stinks, for example, can be used to produce, I'm not sure if I'm even writing those arrows in the right direction. So given a verb, it will produce a sentence. But then you want to formalize an idea that if you combine something like this with a verb which is of this kind, then you will obtain a special class of the sentence. So you'll get a lot of those tensile arrows. And in the end, you'll obtain a very substructural logic, even if you focus just on the behavior of those two things and multiplicative implication between them, which does not even have multiplicative, which does not even need to have exchange. And as I said, by design, it even should not. So until today, the basic calculus for substructural logic with all possible additional connectives added is called full Lambert calculus, or FL. And that's precisely for this reason. And another development that started quite early, I'm not even sure now if I'm getting the chronology right, so I don't want to, because there might have been earlier papers where you have some initial ideas, where was the idea of relevant logics in logical commentary. And whereas here a really critical thing is contraction. Contraction is something in the fuzzy setting was something that we really didn't want to assume too easily, whereas weakening was rather fine. Here things go the other way around. So relevant logicians were extremely irritated about the fact that traditionally, when you teach logic to people, you brainwash them. I mean, you brainwash them, of course, in all sorts of things, but in all sorts of ways. But one way, in one thing that you try to convince people about is has to do with essentially weakening rule, or rather, what the weakening rule gives you on the level of actual valid formulas or valid tautologies. So, having weakening means that you're telling people that. From the fact that 2 plus 2 is equal to 4, that if you have this, then you also obtain as a valid sequence, which then you can turn into a tautology using rules for implication, that the fact that Germany lies between France and Poland implies that 2 plus 2, or entails that 2 plus 2 is equal to 4. And then if you use the rule for implication, you even obtain this as a, and so on, implies 2 plus 2 equals 4. How this thing is implied by this one? Here we are talking about something which is eternally truth, let's say, as we want to believe, as mathematician, or as constructivist witnesses, as long as we have any kind of cognitive subject. Whereas here we're talking about very contingent historical fact that might not have, or if you want to be even more precise, Federal Republic of Germany has between Republic of France and Republic of Poland. And those historical entities, those geography, those states did not even exist some time ago, and we don't know if all of them will keep existing and in the same geographical configuration in the future. So mathematical truth, if you read as implication as providing some justification, reason, so that there should be some material connection between what is on the left and on the right, this is, from their point of view, fundamentally wrong. So relevant logicians were rejecting, they were much more focused on rejecting weakening rather than contraction. So here we have a logic where neither weakening nor contraction are safe. Maybe I should have mentioned this. Not even exchange. Here, mostly weakening was a problem. They were cool, funny enough with contraction, and moreover, they wanted to have this distributive law for lattice or additive connectives, which led to all sorts of bizarre things in their setup. And they wanted to have involutive negation, so these were curious systems, but those were people who were extremely good proof theorists, and they developed very sophisticated deductions and meta-theorems about this deduction. Then, and you know, I don't want to keep it into endless list, I just want to show you that many things were happening before linear logic. So then we have a good way to see what was differentiating. I shouldn't have written this. Differentiating linear logic from all these previous approaches. But at least one more thing that I would like to mention before we go to relevant logic were so-called BCK logics. BCK and BCI. Those names come from combinators. If you have learned about combinatorial approach to lambda calculus, where instead of having this funny syntax with lambda abstraction and you have combinators, it is natural, and in a way there are even popular books like Smulian books, which is trying to present all these things for children. It is natural to ask how large set of combinators you need as primitives. Logics of restricted. So, as I was telling you, but again, this was not something that we could spend too much time on. There is a close correspondence between the full set of combinators for a lambda calculus and intuitionistic logic. So by rejecting some of them, you obtain potentially sublogics of intuitionism, logics which can properly call substructural. The idea is implicitly present even in an article of Schoenfinkel from 1920s, which introduced the whole idea of combinators, and then in 1960s, in the article by two Japanese logicians, Iseki and somebody else, that was developed into full-blown system. Why those things are interesting, or those formalism? It's because a Russian logician, Grishin, pursued the idea of building naive set theory, which is free from Russell paradox, using this kind of formalism. As it turns out, even to derive I don't know if this was discussed in an introduction to set theory, but you know, if you try to formulate foundations of mathematics in a very, very naive way, you very soon obtain inconsistency. And one of important and interesting realizations was that in order to do some kind of natural or obvious mathematical reasoning, in particular the one which shows us that naive ways of handling foundational systems for mathematics. Even here, structural rules that we didn't think so much before. I mean, when people invented paradoxes, they didn't have those Gensen systems and stuff like this, and this fine-grained analysis of proof theory. But even then, those structural rules, which seem so innocent, are lurking somewhere behind. And this is already getting very close to linear logic, which I'm finally going to speak about next, because some of Lyshin's ideas or inventions, they also apply directly. We may even still have time today to mention one of them, to linear logic setup. So, finally, linear logic. Jean-Yves Girard, 1997. What is so special about this formalism? How is it that after so many times where people already came across the idea of restricting those structural rules, we don't see Girard as reinventing the wheel? In the book, one of the books that we mentioned as auxiliary reading for our class, namely the one by Ono, Kowalski and Galatos, they call linear logic probably the first successful and widely used formalism designed with machines rather than human beings in mind. I'm not really sure that Girard would agree. And I think that this may even narrow down his motivation quite a bit. So, on the level of computer science, you can see the logic as the logic of resource control or resource-aware logic. But and I think this is what finally led people to call this kind of logic resource-aware. But also, there was an obvious proof theoretical motivation to what he was doing. And on the proof theoretical level, this was like a fine grain analysis of constructive logic. Since then, people have found many additional interpretation of linear logic. Even in the first chapter of the book by Telstra, you can find surprisingly natural interpretation in terms of Petri nets. And in general, linear logic also started to pop up in formalisms for concurrency. This is actually still some of this research is pretty recent. I mean, this interpretation in terms of Petri nets is quite old. But for example, in the use of linear logic in Carey-Howard correspondence for concurrency, this is much newer stuff. So, what were these distinctive features? What was happening in linear logic as opposed to every attempts that we have seen before? One thing was a very symmetric set of connectives. Particular in its classical variant, As linear logic can come also with classical or intuitionistic variant. And again, the idea is that in order to obtain intuitionistic variant, you just have to forget about most of the things on the right-hand side. But this is not the most important thing. Probably the thing that really made linear logic tick was the idea of having modalities, additional modalities, which are controlling the use of structural rules. And this was one of, maybe I should mention here that those, moreover, those symmetric set of connectives were nicely tied by the use of linear involutive negation. But you will see this live in the sequences that I'm going finally to write now. But this part, the fact that you had special modalities on the so-called bank or of course on the left-hand side, whose role was precisely that if you have a formula preceded with this exclamation mark on the left-hand side, it means that you can copy it as many times as possible, and you can also contract it as many times as you want. And question mark or why not, on the which was doing the same job on the right-hand side. This is something which made really linear logic much more fine-grained analysis of constructive logic, which allowed to embed both intuitionistic and classical logic in a very natural way into this basic linear logic system. So Girard could justifiably claim that these are that they are just more coarse things that you start seeing in much more precise light if you put on better glasses that he is offering. So, finally, I'm sorry that this introduction was so long, but as I said, now I'm going to write a lot of connectives and a lot of rules, and it's better to know where all those rules came from. One more word of warning, I mean, this was a brilliant idea and a brilliant paper, like many other things done by Girard, but he's also more than a bit of a lunatic, and one of the ways in which this lunaticism shows up is his choice of notation. It was absolutely horrible. It was wrong on all possible levels, and this is why people, if you look, for example, at the Trollstra book on linear logic, or the Skeleton, Shipson and Kowalski book, they are writing it using different notation, and I will stick to different notation. I will just tell you what Girard was writing for all the connectives that I write, and you will see probably why I don't want to do the same thing as he does. So let us finally write all the rules. And we will need a lot of space for this. Just to make sure that I'm not missing anything. So first of all, we have good old identity axiom, but this time you can just infer you can just infer alpha from alpha. No more and no less. You cannot put any trash because we don't have structural rules. Well, we will for the time being formulate cat as one of the explicit rules in the system. Then we want to show, of course, that you can get rid of it, but for the time being, what can you do? Are we going to discuss co-determination, Lutz, actually? Lutz? Are we going to discuss co-determination or not really? I'm not so sure myself, but...
We do completeness, and then we show semantic cut admissibility.
Okay.
As we did so far, unless we want to spend the rest of the sentence...
No. So, exchange, not needed explicitly, we again will work with multisets. Okay, these are not all the axioms that one may have, and here I'm already going to devote from Girard's notation, so this is my notation for true constant. And then, as I said, we also need a rule for monoid union. Again, this is not Girard's notation. I will tell you what Girard's notation was. Do we have, yes, we have this as well. Notice that we are not saying here that false constant is the idempotent element. It's rather a killer on the left-hand side. If you have it on the left-hand side, then you have everything. So this is for the axioms, I think, apart from the one saying that zero, so we have unit on the left, but now we also need to have something like unit or an important element on the right. All these things are highly symmetric. Then I'm forgotten about the one rule for so this would be the right rule for a top constant, right rule for unit, left rule for a falsity, left rule for zero, and left rule for unit. Then, first I want to define conjunctions, so multiplicative conjunction, which is also known as tensor, and here are already facing several possible choices how to write it. The way Girard wrote it was this. In future we will a formalism where this connective is written simply as star. And a more common name in broader substructural logic community for this thing is fusion. Am I missing any possible name? There are quite a few, but... times, of course. It can be also called times, sure enough. And this is a term that Girard is using quite often. So you can guess how the right rule for this is going to look, right? It's here we have the left rule for a tensor, and this is going then to be the right rule for a tensor. But as I said, we also want to have corresponding additive connectives. And then we take rules on the left-hand side. Now, Telstra, in his book on linear logic, is writing as. He's writing this additive multiplication this way. Forgive me if I often switch to this way of writing, because at the end of the day, this is supposed to be lattice connected. An important thing is that now it is not going necessarily to distribute over its partner, over its additive disjunction partner. As I show, for this kind of derivations, you need structural rules. And then we take, sorry, I'm writing left and right rules in funny order. And then we take those rules as maybe I should say that. Yes?
Delta 1 missing in the second
multiplicative? Yes, 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 of course it is. Of course, sorry, yes. So here you keep the same gamma and delta because they are additive. But here you combine two different connectives. So maybe let me say already that Girard's notation for this, which is still not the most crazy thing that he proposed, was so this is notation of Telstra. And he was calling this thing whiff. Was there another name? But this is really lattice meet, if you look at or in partially ordered sets. This would be, as I told you, greatest lower bound. So another possible notation that you see, for example, in Galatos or in Kowalski book is just this. Now we need implication, and implication in this setup is multiplicative. And these are the rules that you are already well familiar with. So especially the right rule is still the good old modus ponens. But again, the way in which Girard is writing it, lollipop. Maybe not very conventional. Implies, entails. Well, I'm actually against reading this connective as entails, even though Girard is mentioning, because entailment is something that I could keep on the meta level. So this is the right rule, but we also need the left one. Let me reuse this bit. And this is always the rule. This is just to make mistake. So, sorry, no. Yeah, I knew that would go wrong. So, if you can get alpha 1 or delta from gamma, and on the other hand from alpha 2 and gamma 2 you can get delta 2. Then from gamma 1, gamma 2, and alpha 1, the lollipop alpha 2, you can get delta 1 or delta 2. Okay, now we also need some type of multiplicative disjunctions. This is something that we did not discuss explicitly when motivating the whole setup, but and those rules should be then. Sorry, the rules for multiplicative conjunction turned upside down, kind of. So, and this is also the notation where Girard got most creative, I think. We are going simply write this multiplicative conjunction as plus. Girard's own notation was I don't even know if I can write it. I'm not even sure if I'm starting from the right direction. No. Jesus, I can get it on a piece of paper, but... Right, this way. I think. Par or parallel or. Actually, Girard himself said that this is the most hidden of all the connectives, and he did not discover it until he started to explore fully the De Morgan duality. Only in the setup of intuitionistic linear logic, some sense was made of it only much later by Hyland and De Paiva. I think that I actually need to stop, so maybe I will just write for the sake of symmetry the left rule for multiplicative disjunction. And the rest, including those mysterious modalities controlling the use of structural rules, will have to come tomorrow. So again, just like in case of conjunction, we have one context and concontext with alpha 1, another one with alpha 2, and we use the multiplicative conjunction to multiply or put together both of them. Additive multiplication bank of course modality and why not modality and involutive negation. Continue tomorrow. Sorry for overrunning slightly. So this is a bit of cliffhanger. I mean, at least for this one, you probably can imagine. how the rules will look like. So see you again in 24 hours.